Hello and welcome to the Verity Podcast for Friday, March 5th, 2024. We're the only podcast that keeps separating the fact from the narrative spin. I'm Adam Clark.
And I'm Scott Wallace with today's top headlines. Russia says it and NATO are reaching direct conflict as the alliance turns 75.
Brazil's De Moraes allegedly led a sweeping crackdown on free speech.
A report says the U.S. State Department was at fault over the Afghanistan withdrawal.
Biden tells Netanyahu U.S. policy will change unless civilian suffering in Gaza is addressed.
A majority of Southeast Asians are found to favor China over the U.S. for the first time.
Pakistan's high court judges allege they were coerced by the nation's spy agency.
Human Rights Watch claims Colombia and Panama are failing to protect migrants in the Darien Gap.
Hundreds call on Missouri's governor to forgive a killer's death penalty.
Sean Diddy Combs' sons hire a high-profile lawyer.
And 80% of CO2 emissions are found to be linked to just 57 companies.
Our top story, as NATO reaches its 75th birthday, Russia says it and the alliance are reaching direct conflict. Here are the facts on this story as agreed upon by MarketWatch, the Associated Press, Reuters, and France 24. As the U.S.-led NATO alliance marked 75 years since its founding in 1949, doing so with flags, cake, and marching bands alongside a message from the Secretary General about the importance of unity, Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov told reporters on Thursday that relations between Russia and the alliance have now slipped to the level of direct confrontation. Peskov continued, NATO was already involved in the conflict surrounding Ukraine and continues to move towards our borders and expand its military infrastructure toward our borders. At NATO headquarters in Brussels, where the alliance has this year taken on Sweden and Finland as new members, growing the bloc to 32 countries, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said, "We will continue to strengthen our alliance, and we will continue to work with our partners across the globe on peace and security." This week's summit was attended by U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, and a larger commemoration of NATO's 75th anniversary is expected to be held in Washington this July. He told the summit that decades of peace alongside NATO's principles of democracy, liberty, and the rule of law were being threatened by those who believe that might makes right and who seek to redraw borders by force. Coming as the Russia-Ukraine war entered into its third year, and following a grinding year where Ukraine faced shortages in both men and ammunition, precipitating the loss of Avdiivka and prompting wider Russian gains elsewhere in the Donetsk region, NATO allies are reportedly discussing a $100 billion military aid plan. Stoltenberg declined to comment.
Thank you, Scott, for the facts on our first story today. We're going to start the first round of narrative spins with a pro-establishment narrative, and it's provided by Associated Press. Amid Ukraine's difficult battlefield situation, this is the time for NATO to up its support for Ukraine, not leave the country hanging out to dry after 3 years of fighting. Nonetheless, neither NATO nor Russia wants the possibility of an all-out conflict between nuclear-armed states.
And the pro-Ukraine narrative from Ukrainska Pravda. Ukraine welcomes this NATO Foreign Minister Summit, particularly as Foreign Minister Dmytro Kubela and Stoltenberg will host another meeting of the NATO-Ukraine Council. While voluntary contributions are welcome, Ukraine will seek to secure firmer and more long-term commitments as well.
The spin is going to continue with a pro-Russia narrative provided by TASS. Throughout this conflict and to the present day, Russia has only sought to protect its people, its future, and its sovereignty. Russia was forced to protect its interests in a weaponized way. Take, for instance, the heinous Crocus City Hall attack on Moscow last month. Its perpetrators, regardless of who their backers may be, want nothing more than to see the fall of Russia.
And an establishment critical narrative from American conservative. Due to the West's collective failure of seeking to expand NATO eastwards to Russian borders, it started this war, which has only resulted in Ukraine losing vast swaths of territory, as well as untold numbers of men and women. Rather than continue this foolish tactic and cause more destruction, Ukraine needs to push for peace.
The nerds of the Metaculous Prediction community are going to stop this round of spins with their narrative. They think that there's a 5% chance that there will be a bilateral ceasefire or peace agreement in the Russo-Ukraine conflict in the year 2024.
It is interesting in that I know it's the pro-establishment narrative, but it's saying, you know, this conflict is entering its third year, which means it's been going on for 2 years. And then that pro-establishment narrative is like, after 3 years of fighting, like, no, that's pushing it a little bit. You know, it's 2 years. Come on, guys.
According to a new Twitter Files release, Brazil's De Moraes led sweeping crackdown on free speech. Here are the facts as agreed upon by Michael Schellenberg's X account, New York Times, Associated Press, and Folha de São Paulo. According to the latest Twitter Files release, Brazilian Supreme Court Justice Alexandre de Moraes has pushed a sweeping crackdown on free speech that sought to undermine democracy in the South American country. The investigation results posted Wednesday by Michael Schellenberger claim that de Moraes, in the superior electoral court he leads, made abusive demands to the social media platform in the lead-up to the 2022 presidential elections. The reported unusual requests included the court mandating the platform to supply personal details about users who mentioned a pro-democratic voting hashtag and attempted to censor supporters and allies of then-President Jair Bolsonaro. This comes a little more than a year after Elon Musk, owner of social media platform X, formerly known as Twitter, observed that de Moraes' actions were, quote, extremely concerning. By the time Brazilian-based journalist Glenn Greenwald had revealed a secret order from de Moraes for Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok to block individuals that allegedly incited or supported the January 8, 2023 riots. A Data Folha poll last week found that approval and disapproval ratings of the Supreme Court are about even at 29% and 28%, respectively.
All right, Adam, thanks for that update. The Wall Street Journal brings us the right narrative spin. This release further reasserts that the Brazilian Supreme Court, and specifically de Moraes, poses a significant threat to the country's democracy amid a crackdown on free speech unseen since the 1988 Constitution came into effect. It's outrageous that the judiciary has consistently silenced dissent without due process.
The New Republic is going to counter that with a left narrative. Yet again, Musk's Twitter files promote far-right allegations as if they're the objective truth, and as if freedom of speech was an absolute right worldwide. Tweets must have consequences, especially when extremists undermine the democratic order, so de Moraes' actions made him a democracy crusader, not a tyrant.
And another nerd narrative from Metaculus, there's a 12% chance that Brazil will experience a successful coup d'etat before January 1st, 2040. Do you think that Julian Assange, as he sits in a British prison, is glad that this Twitter files thing is happening, or is he kind of sad that WikiLeaks is no longer the king of released data?
If his ultimate goal was to start this flood of open information, then I think he would be happy.
I think you're probably right.
If his goal was to make money, I think he's pretty pissed off.
Yeah, I would say you're right, yes. A new report claims the U.S. State Department is at fault for the Afghanistan withdrawal. Here are the facts as agreed upon by New York One Spectrum News, The Daily Mail, and CNN. Transcripts of the closed-door interviews of three U.S. Department of State officials regarding the August 2021 U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan have been revealed. The testimony comes from the House Foreign Affairs Committee probe of the withdrawal. The three officials, John Bass, Jim DeHart, and Jane Howell, said that while plans for a non-combatant evacuation operation began in April or May 2021, no such blueprint was in place when they arrived the following August after the Taliban took over Kabul. DeHart said they had to create from scratch a plan to get priority people to the Kabul airport. Howell said the Taliban broke its agreement to admit Americans in a controlled fashion by allowing tens of thousands of people into the Abbey Gate passenger terminal. Regarding their experience coordinating with the military, unlike with the State Department, Howell described her communication as being absolutely lockstep. DeHart said the chain of command was not unclear at any time. This follows testimony from retired General Mark Milley, who blamed the State Department and White House. He claimed that if he could have a do-over, he would have brought the embassy and the State Department out with the military by the middle of July. Retired General Frank McKenzie said they had forces in the region as early as July 9th, but we could do nothing since the State Department wouldn't issue evacuation plans. Milley's request to retain 2,500 troops to maintain control of Bagram Air Base was denied by President Biden.
Thank you, Scott. The Republican narrative for this story is brought to us by Newsmax. The revelations from these testimonies have already exposed Biden's failures, but it's important to note that these witnesses were approved by the White House to speak to the committee. Biden put completely inexperienced State Department personnel in charge of an incredibly fragile situation. Imagine what revelations would emerge if the committee was allowed to inquire about the people Biden has not approved to speak.
And The Guardian brings us the Democratic narrative. Recent reports have certainly cast a shadow over the Biden State Department. But it's important to remember that the plans for a troop withdrawal were established under the Trump administration. In 2020, before Biden took office, Trump made a deal with the Taliban that led to the eventual confusion during the 2021 withdrawal. This was a terrible tragedy for America, but to blame the Biden administration that was forced between a rock and a hard place is unfair.
Well, Scott, the nerds think that there's a 46% chance that Taliban-controlled Afghanistan will be used as a base for anti-NATO terrorism by 2026.
And that's according to the Batacalus prediction community.
So they had this plan set up for the evacuation date, and the Taliban seems like they just flooded the gates so that the people that were supposed to get out couldn't get out.
They did the thing, like if you catch your kid smoking a cigarette, you make him smoke a whole carton. So now it's, oh, you want people to get to the airport? Sure.
You want to take some people? You got to take them all.
Everybody.
Biden tells Netanyahu that U.S. policy will change if civilian suffering is not addressed. Here are the facts as agreed upon by CNN, The Telegraph, Reuters, Axios, and Plus 972. During a Thursday phone call between U.S. President Joe Biden and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, Biden reportedly warned Israel's premier that U.S. policy toward Israel and the war in Gaza will change if it does not implement, quote, steps to address civilian harm. The White House's statement did not include any details regarding a potential shift in policy. The U.S. has expressed concern about the worsening humanitarian situation in Gaza and a potential Israeli operation in Rafah. A meeting between U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Israeli Minister of Strategic Affairs reportedly became heated as the two discussed Israel's plans to evacuate civilians before an operation. The call came after negotiations resumed again earlier this week, with Hamas political leader Ismail Haniyeh saying on Wednesday that the group would stick to its conditions regarding a hostage deal with Israel, including the withdrawal of Israeli forces from Gaza and the return of the displaced to their homes, among other goals. Indeed, a potential Rafah operation has generated controversy, with Senator Chris Coons, the Democrat from Delaware, saying that he would vote to condition aid to Israel if it were to enter Rafah without making, quote, provision for civilians or for humanitarian aid. Meanwhile, Israeli outlet Plus 972 magazine reported on Wednesday that Israel has been using an AI-based program called Lavender to mark all suspected operatives in the military wings of Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad, or the PIJ. The report claimed that the system flagged 37,000 Palestinians as suspected militants and their homes for possible airstrikes. The report also claimed that the military purposefully targeted militants at night when they were expected to be at home with their families, as this made it, quote, easier to locate the individuals in their private houses. The rest of the report detailed how the system functions and acquires targets.
Thanks for those interesting facts, Adam. We have a pro-establishment narrative from NBC News. Israel's war against Hamas is surely just, given the atrocities the group committed during its October 7th attack. However, the Biden administration is losing its patience with Netanyahu's intransigence. Israel must take into account the innocent civilians in Gaza who are trapped between the country's military machine and Hamas's terrorist fighters, as Israel risks pushing Palestinians into Hamas's hands if it does not work to ensure their safety.
That's going to be countered with a pro-Israel narrative provided by Jerusalem Post. Though this has been a tragic war, Israel must eliminate Hamas and restore deterrence with Iran and its proxy Hezbollah. Hamas's military capabilities and infrastructure must be eliminated to ensure Israel's security. To eliminate this capacity for terror, Israel has been forced to use blunt tools to rout Hamas forces, as they are so deeply dug into Gaza's civilian infrastructure. The international community consistently parrots Hamas's propaganda, as Israel worked from the get-go to deliver aid to Gaza and find a solution to end this war.
And the pro-Palestine narrative comes from Middle East Eye. Israel continues to demonstrate that its war is not against Hamas, but against the Palestinian people as a whole. There already is more than enough evidence to suggest that Israeli forces have consistently targeted civilians, even foreign citizens, in the country's campaign to starve the people of Gaza into submission. Though the U.S., Israel's biggest ally, likes to wax about civilian casualties, it must instead exert more pressure to end this war for good.
Well, the nerds and metaculists think that there's a 70% chance that Israel will have de facto power in the Gaza Strip on January 1st of 2025.
A majority of Southeast Asians favor China over the U.S. Here are the facts, as agreed upon by Al Jazeera, The Atlas News, CNBC, Radio Free Asia, Asia News Network, and The Straits Times. For the first time documented in a regular occurring annual survey, a majority of Southeast Asians have said they would prefer to align with China over the U.S. if forced to choose between the rival superpowers. According to the State of Southeast Asia 2024 survey published Tuesday by the Isis Yusof Ishak Institute, 50.5% favored China, while 49.5% opted for the U.S. At 75.1%, Malaysia topped the countries with the highest preference for the PRC. The results showed a majority in the Philippines, 83.3%, and Vietnam, 79%, support the U.S. over China, with Beijing's stance in the South China Sea being the biggest concern for Filipinos and Vietnamese. Furthermore, 38.2% of respondents said U.S. engagement in Southeast Asia has decreased under President Biden, while 67.4% voiced concern about China's growing economic influence in the region. The survey was conducted between January 3rd and February 23rd. And it included 1,994 respondents from academia, businesses, governments, civil society, and the media. Last year, 38.9% of respondents picked China, 61.1% favored the U.S. According to the survey, Japan remains the region's most trusted power, with 58.9% of respondents expressing confidence in the country, followed by the U.S., 42%, the EU, 41%, China, 25%, and India, 24%.
Scott, thank you for the facts. The spins are going to start with a pro-China narrative, and it's provided by CGTN. The findings are impressive evidence that the era of U.S. hegemony is finally ending. People now know that China is the region's most influential economic and geopolitical power, and trust that Beijing's relations with ASEAN countries will continue to improve. Meanwhile, there's a widespread concern about the U.S.'s growing strategic and political regional footprint. The world has entered an era of multipolarity, and China will continue to be a driving force behind this trend.
Time magazine counters with an anti-China narrative. The results are not as clear-cut as the headlines suggest. Rather, they indicate a lack of unified preference for China over the U.S. in the notoriously divided ASEAN bloc. While Beijing's economic influence is growing, many countries fear its expansionist ambitions and are tightening their U.S. defense ties. China's growing influence is acknowledged but doesn't translate into approval. And as a trusted partner, Washington is ready to support the region in bolstering its internal resilience.
Well, the nerds think that there's a 10% chance that there will be a U.S.-China war before the year 2035.
And that's according to the Metaculous Prediction Community.
News out of Pakistan, where their high court judge alleges coercion by their spy agency. And here are the facts as agreed upon by Guardian, Voice of America, Eastern Eye, Geo, and Al Jazeera. Six judges of the Islamabad High Court have claimed that the Interior Services Intelligence, or the ISI, Pakistan's spy agency, has been coercing them to influence their verdicts in cases involving former Prime Minister Imran Khan. In a letter sent to the Supreme Court Judicial Council, the judges alleged that the ISI was meddling in judicial proceedings, quote, to seek a certain outcome. In one of the cases, the judges claimed that they were forced to hear an appeal against Khan even after the majority rejected it. The letter stated that the ISI placed hidden cameras in one judge's lounge and bedroom, while alleging ISI operatives kidnapped and tortured another judge's relative into making false statements. Islamabad said it had established a commission to investigate. However, after the head of the commission recused himself, the Supreme Court constituted a 7-member bench to probe the alleged interference of intelligence agencies in judicial affairs made in the judge's letter. Since Tuesday, threat letters with a toxic powder have reportedly been sent to more than a dozen senior judges of the Islamabad High Court, the Lahore High Court, and Pakistan Supreme Court, including Chief Justice Qazi Faiz Issa. After losing a confidence vote in April of 2022, Khan has been charged in over 100 cases and convicted with sentences ranging from 10 to 14 years imprisonment for corruption, selling state gifts, and revealing state secrets.
All right, Adam, let's get to our narrative A from the Economic Times. The judges bear witness to what is wrong with Pakistan and its democracy. The military and its intelligence services conspired with the U.S. to have Imran Khan wrongfully dismissed from power because he refused to act as their puppet. They then fabricated allegations and pressed the courts to imprison him to guarantee he never again represented the will of the people. Will the Pakistani people stand by as the military steals what's left of Pakistan's democracy?
There's a narrative B, and it's provided by Al Jazeera. The army neither interferes in judicial affairs nor uses intimidation tactics to coerce the judges. Khan, who used his position to undermine democracy, attempted to dissolve parliament to avoid a no-confidence vote, which led to his removal. He is currently using his position to push Pakistan towards civil war. The government and the judiciary must exercise caution to prevent the current political turmoil from escalating further.
And a nerd narrative from Metaculus, there's a 40% chance that Pakistan will experience a successful coup d'etat before 2040.
Let's all have a coup d'etat.
Yeah.
You don't sound excited about the coup d'etats happening there, Scott. It
feels like a lot of work. You know, maybe when I was in my 20s, I'd be into couping, but now, you know, I just turned 40. That sounds like a lot.
Maybe you can do it online.
Oh, there you go.
Maybe a virtual coup d'etat.
It's just social media coup d'etat, yeah. Colombia and Panama are not helping migrants in the Darien Gap. Here are the facts. As agreed upon by Al Jazeera, Barron's, the LA Times, the Associated Press, and Tico Times. Human Rights Watch claimed on Wednesday that Colombia and Panama have failed to protect hundreds of thousands of migrants and asylum seekers traveling northbound through the dangerous Darien Gap. The rights group claimed in a 110-page report that 1,500 cases of sexual violence have been reported since 2021 along the key corridor for migrants, accusing both countries of not doing enough to hold perpetrators accountable. HRW has urged them to coordinate a humanitarian response to improve security and allow more assistance from international groups in the thick rainforest, which has no roads. The organization further exhorted Panama specifically to reconsider its recent decision to block the medical charity Doctors Without Borders from its territory. Meanwhile, Colombia has been called on to prosecute the drug cartel Gulf Clan, which allegedly controls the Colombian side of the jungle and charges as much as $125 per migrant crossing into Panama. This report comes days after Panama announced that over 109,000 irregular migrants passed through the gap in the first quarter of 2024, up from around 87,000 during the same period in 2023, the year when an all-time high of 520,000 individuals was recorded.
Thank you, Scott. We're going to start the spins with a left narrative, and it's provided by Human Rights Watch. After several visits to the Darien Gap and interviews with migrants and government officials, HRW has revealed the extent of the horrors those on their way to a better life have to face in the Darien Gap. No matter their reason for making this trek, it's the duty of Panama and Colombia to provide them with basic necessities like food, water, and health care. Allowing violent smugglers to bring migrants through the jungle is neither efficient nor moral.
And the right narrative spin from Center for Immigration Studies. All the humanitarian rhetoric coming from governments and NGOs is a facade to hide their true goal, encouraging as many illegal immigrants as possible to reach the U.S. border. It seems that the U.S. has sent hundreds of millions of dollars to Panama and Colombia, not to help stop these waves of migrants who are coming from as near as Haiti and as far as China, but to help those governments guide these illegal convoys more efficiently on their way to the U.S.
Well, Scott, the nerds think that there's a 50% chance that the rate of immigration enforcement in the U.S. in 2024 as a percentage of removals to encounters will be at least 5.8%.
And that's according to the Metaculous Prediction Community.
Hundreds ask Missouri governor to grant Dorsey clemency. Here are the facts as agreed upon by Guardian, St. Louis Today, the Kansas City Star, Los Angeles Times, and St. Louis Public Radio. More than 150 people, including 70 current and former prison workers, have asked Missouri Governor Mike Parson to grant clemency to Brian Dorsey, who is scheduled to be executed next week for murdering his cousin and her husband in 2006. Dorsey on Tuesday filed an appeal with the U.S. Supreme Court, arguing that his attorneys provided, quote, grossly deficient representation in a capital case. Appointed through the Missouri State Public Defender, his lawyers were each paid a flat fee of $12,000. Missouri no longer allows flat fee compensation for public defenders. Dorsey's current counsel says his old lawyers did not provide him with a sufficient level of representation. According to figures from federal courts, Dorsey's lawyers were paid $3.37 per hour if they spent the standard 3,557 hours on his case. However, no one disputes the fact that Dorsey killed Sarah Bonney and her husband before sexually assaulting her. The Missouri Supreme Court upheld Dorsey's conviction and life sentence in 2009. Retired Judge Michael Wolfe, who served on the bench at the time, wrote in an op-ed that he regrets his decision and he was, quote, unaware of how compromised the lawyers were. Barring an intervention, Dorsey will be executed on April 9th. Parson has never granted a request for clemency.
Thanks, Adam. Narrative A on this sobering story comes from the New York Times. Parson should grant Dorsey clemency. Prison workers and even the judge who upheld his death sentence are unified in their belief that Dorsey was failed by the justice system. Dorsey has been a model citizen for the past 18 years, and he shouldn't die because he wasn't allowed proper counsel.
That's going to be followed with a narrative B provided by the Office of the Missouri Attorney General. This outpouring of support for Dorsey is turning him from a cold-blooded murderer into a victim, but Parson can't let it affect him. No one is questioning whether Dorsey committed those heinous crimes, and his conviction has been upheld multiple times. Dorsey must be punished for what he did.
And a nerd narrative from Metaculous, there's a 50% chance that capital punishment will be legal in at least 39% of U.S. states in 2035. Sean Diddy Combs' sons hire a high-profile lawyer. Here are the facts as agreed upon by Fox News, News Nation, The Independent, and The Mirror. The sons of entertainment mogul Sean Diddy Combs, whose homes were raided by Homeland Security last week as part of a sex trafficking investigation, have hired lawyer Jeffrey Lichtman, who has represented high-profile clients including El Chapo and John Gotti Jr. During the raid, armed officers confiscated firearms and cell phones belonging to Combs. They also handcuffed two of his sons, Christian and Justin, leading their mother, Misa Hilton, and Lichtman to accuse the police of excessive use of force. Combs faces civil suits related to four sexual abuse allegations from three women and one man. He has not been charged. Allegations include his ex-girlfriend, who claims she was trafficked and assaulted over 10 years. Another woman claims she was drugged and abused in 1991. Other allegations include those of producer Rodney Lil Rod Jones, who also implicated actor Cuba Gooding Jr. in the alleged abuse. Combs has denied all accusations and called the raid on his homes a gross overuse of military-level force. Citing the fact that neither Combs nor any of his family members have been arrested, Lichtman, in a statement, called the investigation a witch hunt, adding that an advanced, coordinated media presence has led to a premature rush to judgment.
Thank you. The spins are going to start with the narrative A provided by Smart Core Tech. This entire story has been blown out of proportion because an unnecessarily violent raid was filmed. There have been no arrests, and there's no evidence of wrongdoing. Combs' celebrity will inspire the media to keep this story alive, but this witch hunt should eventually blow over.
And narrative B comes from the New York Post. This story isn't a media creation. It's the result of decades of Combs' abuse and shady non-disclosure agreements finally coming to light. After years of not facing the music, Combs' clock has finally run out, and neither he nor the government will be able to sweep his crimes under the rug.
Our final story today is a report that says 80% of CO2 emissions are linked to just 57 companies. Here are the facts as agreed upon by Reuters, Offshore Engineer Magazine, Guardian, Axios, Carbon Majors, and BBC News. According to the Carbon Majors report published on Thursday, just 57 fossil fuel and cement producers have been linked to 80% of the world's carbon dioxide, or CO2 emissions, since 2006. While many governments and companies set strict emissions targets to combat climate change, a small group of emitters produced and burned more fossil fuels between 2016 and 2022, raising CO2 emissions. Among the world's 122 biggest historical climate polluters, the researchers found that 65% of state-owned entities and 55% of investor-owned companies had expanded production in the 7 years after the Paris Climate Agreement was signed. The world's top three state-owned CO2-emitting firms are Saudi Aramco, Russia's Gazprom, and Coal India. ExxonMobil, Shell, BP, and Chevron lead the list of biggest investor-owned CO2-emitting companies. In its long-term analysis, the researchers said that investor-owned companies accounted for 31% of all emissions, while state-owned companies were linked to 33% and nation-states for 36%. China's coal production accounted for 14% of historic global CO2 emissions, the highest. In 2015, 194 world leaders agreed to cut greenhouse gas emissions to prevent global temperatures from rising by more than 1.5 degrees Celsius. However, according to the Independent Climate Action Tracker, the world is on track for another 2.1 degrees Celsius of warming by 2100.
All right, Adam, our final round of narrative spin starts with Narrative A from the New York Times. It's shocking that so few powerful corporations and multinationals are the leading drivers of the global climate crisis. The cohort continues to profit from extracting fossil fuels when it should be slowing down production. This report's findings will allow international institutions to hold the culprits accountable for climate damages.
Washington Post is going to continue the spin with a narrative B. This report is sensationalizing a picture that could change in the future. Companies worldwide have been taking voluntary action to meet net zero emission targets and invest in renewable energy, including the world's biggest oil and gas producers agreeing to cut methane emissions from their wells and drilling by more than 80% by 2030. This is all happening despite the debate on climate change not being settled.
And a final nerd narrative from Metaculus. There's a 50% chance that at least 80.8% of the world's primary energy will come from fossil fuels in 2025. Thanks for listening to the Verity Podcast for Friday, April 5th, 2024.
Each day we use machine learning to read about 5,000 articles from about 100 newspapers and figure out which ones are about the same stories. For each major story, our editorial team that extracts both the key facts that all articles agree on and the key narratives where the articles differ.
For more information on Verity, visit our website, verity.news, or you can download the Verity app on the Apple App Store or Google Play. For Adam Clark, I'm Scott Wallace, inviting you to join us next time on Verity.